Okay, so our next speaker is Alan Dakin, who's a geologist from my neck of the woods in Hamilton, Ontario. He's going to talk more about NOAA, no doubt another perspective.
Yes, good point there. So I actually feel, of course, I know people are going to be going in, coming in and going out for a few minutes here. I actually feel I should give a sort of personal reflection before my sort of official talk, which is, we've heard this afternoon, and you're going to hear more evidence, with quite conflicting interpretations, let's be honest. So in some ways, I'm going to claim, perhaps at least, that there's some parallels with climate science here. The first thing is to make progress, well, we actually do need to change our minds. And so if everyone just holds to their position, well, we're not going to make much progress. You know, this has happened in the climate field. People have changed their minds. But the key point, of course, is in response to evidence. So I want to just testify that I've changed my mind over the years in several important points that I believed, theories that I read that seemed to me like they were inspired, and it turned out they were mainly wrong when other people basically refuted them. So, it's just a challenge, basically, to we should all have an open mind, and then we may converge on a closer approximation to reality. So, that was my preamble. All right. So, excuse me. Okay, so we have two opposite extreme views, if you like, here, of the flood. And you could label them in slightly different ways. So I've called it the creationist view, a global flood. It's obviously the version that was popularized by William Morris. The idea that all the sedimentary strata were laid down by the flood, all humans except Noah's family died. On the opposite extreme, arguably, is what I'm calling the liberal view, which is that the flood is really largely a parable. And so Paul Seeley, who most of you know, this is what he said on Biologos: the flood, not global, barely local, mostly theological. And a similar opinion from John Goldingay in his Genesis commentary. I can't remember exactly what it was called, but he says, "I assume the flood is another more parabolic," meaning to do with a parable, obviously, "parabolic rather than historical story." Well, frankly, I think it is a tragic type dichotomy, because I think neither of these positions is amenable to buy-in from the other side. You know, they are so far apart that it's very difficult for the other side to buy into them. Yeah. So, if I was to very briefly critique the flood geology, the global flood view, for one thing, ancient peoples didn't know that the Earth was a globe. So we shouldn't talk of a global flood anyway, because that's meaningless in ancient terms. To be honest, there's no geological evidence for a global flood. Obviously, not everyone agrees with that, but most geologists agree. And, for example, a trivial argument, but anyway, there are lumps of wood in California, Californian mountains, I forget, the White Mountains or something, which in fact have been dated to more than 8,000 years ago. They're lying on the ground. Obviously, there couldn't be a flood in that time or they'd have floated away. That's a kind of trivial argument. But what I really want to address in more detail, though, is the flood parable argument. And the problem here is, If we downgrade the significance of the flood to being mainly theological, barely happened, frankly,
it destroys the basis of faith, which is to say, you know, Hebrews 11, by faith, whatever, Noah built an ark and God saved him, to paraphrase it badly. I'm going to say that at least for the woman in the street, let's say, this undermining of faith is really the driver that pushes them to the creationist position, because, you know, your typical church member can't accept that their faith could be misled, you know, that God didn't really have to save Noah from some catastrophe. So therefore, what I'm trying to argue is, we need a more credible explanation for the flood, because then we wouldn't be undermining faith, and then there would be no need for people to go over to the flood geology model. And that's basically what I want to talk about. Yeah. So here is a summary of the Sumerian king list, which I think pretty much resembles what we saw earlier. And the oldest is at the top here, and here, of course, is the flood according to the Sumerian king list, and then this is the beginning of the post-diluvian king list. And so this is the argument for dating the flood 2900 BC. The Sumerian king list places it before the kingdom of Kish. We know that the kingdom of Kish began around 2900 BC. That's the beginning of the so-called early dynastic period. And we also know that the king list agrees with the Mesopotamian flood stories, or specifically the Sumerian flood story, that the flood hero came from Shurippak. So this appears to be a self-consistent picture from independent lines of Mesopotamian evidence. Okay, so why we shouldn't believe this evidence? So the first thing is that historians agree, let's say, that the king list was actually composed at two different times. There was an original king list compiled the late third millennium, shortly before the time of Abraham, actually. It would be called the Third Dynasty of Ur, and they wanted to establish their inheriting of the earlier Sumerian tradition, and therefore they compiled a king list that went back to Kish I, the first dynasty of Kish, which was very famous in Sumerian history, and they were establishing their connectedness with this historical evolution of kingship, and the antediluvian, the before the flood part, was added later on, and the source of this material is the Sumerian flood story. So in other words, it's no wonder that this agrees with the Sumerian flood story, because that's where it came from, and it was added on later on. We know that this is not true here, because, in fact, because Uruk was the dominant world center politically for more than 500 years before the first dynasty of Kish. But archaeologists call this the Uruk world system, and they call the end of this the collapse. It's a very dramatic situation that Uruk had world dominance and then it collapsed, and then after that, the early dynastic period. So frankly, this is not really historical. It's a story that comes out of the Sumerian flood story. So what has that got to do with this? This is a summary. Why the Sumerian king list shouldn't be used to determine when the flood actually occurred. So firstly, it was hundreds of years later. So there was a medium-sized flood at Kish just before this Kish dynasty. But I mean, it was a long time before the King List was compiled. We know that the King List doesn't really know what happened before the dynasty of Kish because Uruk was dominant and it doesn't know about that. The King List was composed as political propaganda. This is agreed by historians. It's not to say the King List doesn't contain a whole lot of useful information, important information. It's just that it's not gospel truth. We shouldn't uncritically accept what it says unless there's really archaeological evidence. Yeah, and the other thing is, human beings love to manipulate ideas, and it's very easily to understand that they could have conflated different events. So, for example, a story of a flood, the story of a cataclysmic flood, which could have suited their political ends to conflate it with a flood before the dynasty of Kish. Okay, so what's my evidence for the fact that the flood actually occurred earlier than this? Well, one of the important biblical arguments, or biblical belief, if you like, is that all the Middle Eastern peoples were descended from Noah. That's only credible. Whether or not it's true, it doesn't matter. The fact is that they believed it was true, and it's only credible that they believed that if the flood was truly an ancient event, and therefore allowing time for all these people to have spread out after the flood. The biblical account says the flood lasted a year, and yeah, this magnitude of flood would have done severe damage to, you know, the ziggurats and so on, and there's no sign of that damage. So logically, the flood happened before all these Sumerian cities. So here's a very brief summary of some geological evidence. There are some drill cores in southern Mesopotamia, which were drilled in the 1970s or something. They were analyzed, the sedimentology was analyzed in the 80s and 90s, by a guy called Iraqui or something, Iquari. They call this a fence diagram, which does stratigraphic correlation. The important thing is here is that this is a layer which is very rich in organic matter, which is in fact recognized very widely in the Eastern Mediterranean. It's called Sapropel 1, in fact, because there are older ones. But this is indicative of an extremely wet period, and it's been dated to about 5500, just over around 5500 BC. Subsequently, there was a marine inundation of the plain. In actual fact, though, these could have happened at the same time. The marine inundation could have exacerbated a very wet period, and this is really the smoking gun of a flood, okay? A known period of extreme rainfall throughout the Eastern Mediterranean and the sources of the Tigris and Euphrates, and a period just before Mesopotamian culture. And this is the cultural context here. Okay, so this is a chart date here, BC, and I've grouped some of the radiocarbon evidence here. This is northern Mesopotamia before the flood. This is the Sapropel date here. This is northern Mesopotamia after the flood. In the middle here is southern Mesopotamia. So we have three sites here, Ueli, Asabaya, which is in Kuwait, and Uruk. Unfortunately, there's not very much early data from Uruk, but what you can see is that all of these three sites post-date the Sapropel. So the question is, why are there no remains before the Sapropel in southern Mesopotamia? Because there are such remains in northern Mesopotamia. There's no intrinsic reason why there shouldn't be remains from before this very wet period. Okay, simplistically, they all got washed away by the flood. Is that so naive? Well, I don't really think it's so naive. Right, now, I don't know how much of my time, I've used half my time, maybe, let's hope I have. So what I want to look at now is what does Genesis say about the flood? That was kind of largely the historical geological evidence. And so, to know what Genesis means, we need to know, understand the history of it, Genesis itself. And this is the question of whether Genesis was derived from more than one ancient source, a theory which is normally called the documentary hypothesis, and I want to try to explore this, the application of this to the flood story, okay? So the documentary hypothesis, to summarize very quickly, says that there were three main sources for Genesis, P, J, and E, Priestley, Yahwist, that's begins with a J because it's the German, Eloist, and one way they're recognized is by the different use of divine name, and there are other features, we'll get to that. Yeah, now unfortunately, the documentary hypothesis was basically corrupted by Wellhausen. The key thing is, and of course this is like 120 years ago, and we're still living with this today. He linked the documentary hypothesis to a theory of the evolution of the Jewish religion that said that the sources we just talked about were all basically fabrications. And here's a quote which illustrates this. Wellhausen's commenting, "The priestly document, one of the sources, has actually been successful with its movable tabernacle, its wandering camp, and other archaic details in so concealing the true date of its composition that its many serious inconsistencies with what we know are only taken as proving that it lies far beyond all history." In other words, Wellhausen's saying, yeah, if you were smart, you'd realize that the Exodus is a fabrication written by later Jewish scholars. Well, it's not surprising that evangelicals are like revolted against this idea, and of course they threw out the baby with the bathwater. So the challenge is, if we remove this linkage that we receive from Wellhausen, can we reinstate the documentary hypothesis as a purely descriptive hypothesis to discuss the sources of Genesis and, of course, the rest of the Pentateuch as well? So here's one specific example regarding the birth of Benjamin, and on the left we have the so-called priestly source, and on the right the Eloist source. So what you can see here, it says, Jacob had 12 sons of Leah, Leah's servant. These were the sons of Jacob who were born to him in Padan Aram, and of course Benjamin is included here, whereas in the Eloist account, we have a vivid description of the birth of Benjamin while Jacob was traveling from Bethel to Ephrath in Israel, and of course Rachel died in childbirth, and this story describes the birth of Benjamin in Israel, right? So you can see here there is a different recollection of events, if you like. Now, we could say this is a contradiction, but it would be better to say that these two sources have slightly different viewpoints of history. The priestly source is having a global viewpoint, and it's concerned with the fact that, yeah, more or less, all of these sons were born in Padan Aram, and it's not going to bother the fact that one maybe wasn't. Whereas this is a vivid description of history. So this is evidence for two sources with distinct viewpoints, okay? Now, we can see this in the creation and the flood. But the curious thing is, regarding the creation, these two sources, Genesis 1 and Genesis 2, are separate. And you know, they've got very different viewpoints, the cosmic viewpoint, the local viewpoint. Whereas the flood story, they're interleaved. And I credit this to Dennis Lamro, who persuaded me that I should pay attention to this evidence for the flood story. Okay, so I don't really have time, but briefly, what we've got here is the Yahwist account of creation and the flood. And according to Dennis's tabulation, you can see, of course, they both use the name Yahweh, but they also use certain specific phraseologies which are very distinctive. I've highlighted some of them in red. For example, one of the most curious, referring to animals as man and woman. I mean, that's a weird usage, which is very distinctive, you know, the man line and the woman line, assuming this is correct. And, oh, the breath of life in nostrils. That's a kind of a strange term in phraseology. Well, in the priestly creation of flood, we have different terminology that's also distinctive. Like, for example, referring to birds as wing and an obsession with creeping things. Okay, so anyway, this is evidence that we have two distinct sources. Now, these sources have different viewpoints of the flood as a cosmic event. And I quote here from Friedman, who is one of the proponents of the documentary hypothesis. In the P creation story, God creates a space, the firmament, that separates waters above the sky from waters below, and the universe is a bubble surrounded by water. In the P flood story, the apertures of the flood, the apertures of the skies and the fountains of the deep are broken, and the waters flow into this bubble, like drowning this bubble. In J, in the Yahwist account, it simply rains. These are two very different viewpoints, cosmically, of what the flood is. But what you notice is they both have exactly the same description of the effects. Everything died in the red. And also, the Mesopotamian epic sources agree that everything died. In the Atrahasis epic, the gods are saying, how come Noah, or the flood hero, survived? Because everyone else died, basically. And in the Gilgamesh epic, vividly, flood hero, I looked at the weather site after the flood. He's looking out over the plain of Mesopotamia. Silence reigned for all mankind who returned to clay. The floodplain was as flat as a roof, right? This is quite clear. Everything died. Okay, so the question is, why do evangelicals not take this evidence for seriously? Well, one reason, which we've already discussed, is the genealogies. This is a summary of the genealogies and genealogy of Shem, the life histories, and it shows the embarrassing fact, according to the Masoretic text, that Noah's lifespan overlapped with Abraham and that Shem outlived Abraham, right? So this awkwardness of the genealogies is one reason people maybe don't take this evidence seriously. But the thing is, as we've already heard, actually Abraham's lifespan is also almost incredible. I mean, 180 years is not actually any more relatable than these life spans. But when you look at the documentary hypothesis, you realize all of these records are from the priestly source. In the Yahwist, he just says, Genesis 6:3, well, in fact, God says, man will be limited to 120 years. So in other words, these two sources are again giving completely different viewpoints of human longevity. So if you separate these two viewpoints out, you'll see, in fact, if you read the Yahwist account, which Friedman calls the hidden book in the Bible, he's actually published it as a specific book. Frankly, the Yahwist account of the flood is just as credible as Abraham, as the life of Abraham. So, you know, why should you believe one and not the other? And for example, also, is the ark credible? Well, both the biblical and the Mesopotamian accounts say that the ark's the size of a 1 acre field. Well, in Mesopotamia, there are 1 acre fields. Okay, they're not floating, but they are made of reeds mixed with mud. So it's not completely unbelievable. You could have a raft with a large hut on it with three stories. Okay, so the point I'm trying to make here then is we put the flood far enough back in history, it's believable as a real event. So we shouldn't believe that the flood was as recent as 2900 BC, because it's not credible that it was wiping out the whole human race. If we believe it happened, whatever, a couple of thousand years earlier, it's much more credible that the whole of the known Earth was destroyed, and all Middle Eastern people groups were descended from Noah. So then we can infer, yeah, Noah really was a real person, and therefore we should take the history of Genesis seriously as having a significant component of real history, but told in a way, you know, which is not like modern science. Okay, that's it. Thank you. So trying to give you a sort of 30-second answer of my opinion. Well, the first thing is that the Tower of Babel is itself a historical, an anachronistic conflation. We know that Abraham left Mesopotamia long before Babylon became a dominant center. So credibly, in actual fact, if you read the text, you'll see it doesn't exactly say that it was the Tower of Babel. It just strongly implies it. So it's really a kind of a wordplay. You know, I mean, the Hebrews were in the exile in Babylon, and they were subjected to seeing the Tower of Babel there, and obviously they wanted to make a play of this. So we should look for the Tower of Babel much earlier. John Walton actually has said in passing that the stage tower of Eridu could be the Tower of Babel. Although actually I think the stage tower of Uruk is much more likely, because we also have the collapse of Uruk, which would tie in with the dispersion of peoples after the Tower of Babel. Now, it'd take you a bit of rearrangement of your mind, because the chronology I'm giving you is completely different from what you've been hearing, right? So, but I believe personally that if you readjust your mind, it would make more sense.
Actually, if I may interject more comment, you were talking about changing your mind,
Say?
Anyway, and your first comment about keeping an open mind, yeah, I would agree with, but I'm not sure your climate change analogy works.
Okay.
When you're looking at biblical literature, so my comments are from a biblical theological perspective, and when you're looking, and you had a whole lot of terms there, like fiction, stylized history, invented history, parable, those are not typically terms that I've heard when referring to Genesis 1 to 11. You did talk about the primeval history. One of the cardinal rules I'm sure people have heard is never look at ancient literature with 21st century eyes. So even the Sumerians, other ancient literature, they were viewing truth, but in a very different sort of way. So it was quite acceptable to conflate things, to edit, to put things together.
Yes.
It wasn't considered that they were just inventing something.
No, no.
A parable is a story that's invented to tell a truth. Whereas when you, myth, in our modern sense, we use myth to mean untrue. In the ancient sense, myth was actually truth, but told in a very different sort of way. And I don't know if anybody was in my talk last year on metaphor, but again, metaphors convey truth. The metaphors are not just a fiction, they are actually conveying truth. But when you're talking about such important historical, prehistorical, how you want to, events, like the creation of the world, and because it's so remote, we can't use science to look at it and understand it. So we have to use the language of metaphor. That's very powerful language that's depicting truth.
Yes, up to a point, obviously. Okay. I suppose my comment would be, biblical concept of real history versus parable doesn't necessarily reflect Middle Eastern views. I know that we have a slight difference of opinion here, so this is fine. So I don't think I really need to give a sort of a opposing position.
Yep, okay.
We'll leave it for future evolution.
Any other questions, comments?
Did you say that bark was made out of reeds?
Well, I said...
The Bible says made out of gopher wood.
Yeah, no. I said I think it's credible that you can make a raft of wood and you can have a reed-built house on that raft. And that, frankly, this is the only way you can make this credible as a real story. As I say, it's significant that there's for sure two Mesopotamian sources which say the size of the ark is 1 acre. They don't call it the ark, but whatever. They say it's the size of 1 acre. There's the Gilgamesh epic, the flood story in that, and then there's also the recently discovered Ark tablet, which was described by Finkel, the Syriologist, which claimed that the Ark was circular, but the important thing is it was still one acre in size, and that of course is also the size of the Ark in the Bible, 1 acre. I mean, if you calculate it out, it's very close to an acre. So, I think if you put this agricultural spin on the ark, which is, really where we're at in, this is Neolithic times, you should think of it, what was likely in Neolithic times, if you were going to envisage something that was real, then why not have a raft of, a few thousand logs, you could make a raft, and then you can have a rebuilt house on it. Of course, in the Mesopotamian stories, the god of wisdom specifically tells the flood hero, tear down your house, build a boat. So there's that strong element in those stories of tearing down the reed-built house and building the boat. Well, I don't think the boat itself was built of reeds, but it's very believable that there was a house on the boat built of reeds.
Okay, one more question.
In the epics, there are Sumerian boatmen on the ark, and the tablet, which I deleted it out of time, that's retrieved from Uruk, shows a king in a boat with an animal and boatmen who are obviously Sumerian. So I find difficulty fathoming out why you would think the Sumerians came from Noah, that he would have been the ultimate progenitor of the Sumerian people.
Okay, well, I think that's too complex a question to answer it exactly. I mean, I'm not really sure what the, I think the issue is
the form of dress, is that what you're questioning, as the identification of Sumerians and Semitic peoples? I don't know if that's where you're coming from.
I'm just saying it's difficult for me to have the Sumerians coming from Noah.
Yeah.
When it's probably, in my estimation, more likely that they were a culture side by side with the Akkadian culture. That's what I'm trying to say.
Yeah. Well, of course, I didn't originate that particular theory. Povel, one of the Assyriologists, and what's his name? Anyway, various other people have said it before, so I'm not claiming originality, and these details still have to be fleshed out, so I don't think we can settle it, quickly, but, more study might clarify, let's say.
Okay, so let's thank all our speakers.
Thank you.